All right, so I'm Stephen, and the topic of my lecture is simulating physics with quantum computers. And so the first thing you might ask is, why do we want to learn about this in the first place? So one reason for that is someday when we have large-scale universal quantum computers, this could be practically useful. But a second reason is that this framework gives us a way to compare the computational power of different physical systems. So roughly speaking, if we have two physical systems, A and B, and A can efficiently simulate B, then somehow we know that the computational power of A must be at least as much or comparable to B, because anything you could solve with system B, you could always emulate whatever algorithm you used to solve it on B using A. And similarly, if B can simulate A, then B must be sort of at least as powerful. And if each can simulate the other efficiently, then these things must, in some sense, be computationally equivalent. So then the question is, can we make this into this kind of rough notion into something mathematically precise? And there's a way to do that which has proven to be fruitful over the years, which is to just declare that what we mean by efficiently is polynomial time. So the sort of computer science or complexity theory jargon is that efficient equals polynomial time. And more precisely, polynomial time means the number of elementary steps in our underlying model of computation, whether it be logic gates or hops of a Turing machine from one tape to another, or quantum gates in a quantum system, should scale just as some polynomial in the input size that you can measure by, say, the number of bits used to describe the input. So for example, if we have something like n squared, that's efficient. 2 to the n, not efficient. Now, this definition, one could object to it on many different grounds. So for example, should we really call something that runs an n to the 65 time efficient? In any practical sense, that's really not. There are a couple of answers to that, though. One is that in practice, this very rarely happens. Algorithms that you actually discover, most typically, either they run in some relatively low power, maybe they run like quadratically or cubically in the input. In some cases, the first version of an algorithm someone discovers and is able to prove convergent scales rather poorly, maybe n to the sixth or n to the nine or something. But in those cases, it's usually found that over the years, subsequent improvements to the algorithm bring it down to something reasonable. So that's one answer. But a second reason that this, and maybe even a more important reason ultimately, that this definition of calling polynomial time efficient is a good convention is that it has nice mathematical properties. And in particular, it's transitive. So that if you have some system A that can simulate B with polynomial overhead, and B can simulate C, then definitely A can simulate C. That's just because polynomials are closed under composition. So now, because of this transitivity, this notion of computational equivalence that we've defined here with A can efficiently simulate B and B can efficiently simulate A, it defines an equivalence relation on the set of all different models of computation or physical systems that you can propose. So you can start to map out some kind of constellation of different forms of computation. So a classic example you may have heard about is Turing machines. Say, classical Turing machines just acting on bits. Then you can come up with other formal models of computation, some which are just trivially different, like Turing machines on trits, three states for each location on the tape. You can come up with ones that are a little closer to the real world, say maybe logic circuits. You can look in dusty old tomes and find strange models of computation that in the 1930s were competing with Turing machines to be the definition of computation, such as Alonzo Church's lambda calculus. Yes. Yeah, so at present, I'll think of this as one gets the same answer. You can also define stronger notions of simulation, like if your model of computation is fundamentally probabilistic, then maybe you might want to simulate sample from entirely the same probability distribution that the original system samples from. But the most traditional way of thinking about it is you're just trying to get the same answer. It turns out that in recent work, people have been sort of recasting this whole thing in terms of sampling problems, and your notion of simulation is sampling from the same output distribution, and that has its pros and cons. It's a little bit less directly tied to what we usually really want in a computation. On the other hand, it turns out that in the sampling framework, it seems a lot more feasible to prove actually some of these separations between different models of computation than it is in the traditional decision problem framework. And so Scott Aronson is one of the leaders in the sampling complexity reformulation. But anyway, for now I'll talk about solving problems. And so here's like another one, which is cellular automata. And then you have like a whole bunch of things out here, each of which may or may not be equivalent to other ones. And over the years, the computer scientists sort of mapped this out. So there's a few motivations for this, one of which is that if you pick some definition and you start working out, okay, these are the problems that are easy to solve, these are the ones that can be solved in polynomial time using your model, these are some other problems which apparently cannot, you might be kind of worried that you're, in some sense, wasting your time. Maybe someone else will come back, study the whole thing in a framework of trits instead of bits, and get a completely different set of answers. But these equivalences kind of show that that's not the case, that the answers you get are something kind of permanent and universal, not some artifact of the details of the model you've chosen. So in some way, that's skipping ahead of a little bit. I mean, that's really why we can have the IT from Qubit conference, and we don't have to have a separate conference next year, which is IT from Qtrit, and so on and so forth. All right, so this is a way of comparing computational power. And again, there are a lot of questions and objections that could be raised. So for example, in the real world, things are finite. This is all about asymptotic complexity. Does it scale as a polynomial versus an exponential, say, in the limit of problem size going out to infinity? So maybe what you really might want to know is, well, we have some system in practice, we can say maybe apply 1,000 gates or something, what can we solve with that system? Why are we not studying that? And, well, the first answer is some people do study that, but that's kind of a different subject. It's more of applied computer science. We're going to stay with big picture stuff here. The second reason is, that's very hard because in that case, things really are quite sensitively dependent on the details of your underlying model. So you do have to actually just analyze case by case. Well, in this system we can compute this, in that system we can compute this. Once we sort of coarse grain to just saying what's polynomial, we can get kind of more universal truths. And a third reason, of course, for studying asymptotics is that, you know, over the past 50 years, computers have been exponentially growing in power, and so we're always moving deeper and deeper into this asymptotic regime where these complexity theoretic things become more relevant. Okay, so then the big question is, all right, so we start coming up with every physical system, every model of computation that we can think of, and we're drawing these equivalences between them, finding these equivalence classes, in other words, connected components of this big graph that I'm drawing here. So the question is, how many equivalence classes, how many connected components are there in this kind of map of the computational landscape? And the answer to that is essentially, there's basically just two of these equivalence classes of computation that we know of so far, at least in terms of universal computation. So here what I've drawn right now is classical computing. And then there's another big blob, as I'm sure you've all heard, which is quantum computing. And in that case, there are also many different models that one can propose. And so far, every model that people have proposed appears to be, or in fact has been proven to be, polynomially equivalent to others. So here we have things like quantum circuits, which John Watrous gave some nice lectures on earlier this week. Can also define quantum Turing machines, which are analogous to classical Turing machines, but with transition amplitudes instead of transition rules. And again, we can do this with qubits. We can do this with qutrits. So here's quantum Turing machine. Qutrits. We can come up with different gate sets for quantum circuits. Of course, there's topological quantum computing, which some people may be familiar with. And basically, there's all these different models, and each one can simulate the others with polynomial overhead. Here's adiabatic quantum computing. That equivalence was shown in a paper by Dorita Haranov and some collaborators. And so basically what we've got here is just two big equivalence classes, quantum and classical. And if you think about it, it doesn't seem so obvious a priori that this is the way that things would have turned out. In a way, maybe it's kind of amazing, but this is all we've found. Of course, another question is, we've drawn this big map here, you know, what about quantum gravity, way off in sort of the terra incognita on the edge of this map? How is that going to fit in here? I think the real answer is we don't know. I think it's a great and important question. I mean, really, one of the most fundamental and kind of coarse-grained basic questions you can ask about a universe, I think, is, what's the set of problems you can solve in polynomial time in it? And so I don't think we really know the answer to that yet. Although the natural guess would be this class. Yeah. Yeah, so there's no proof that there couldn't be somewhere someday a bridge found like this. There's various evidence for that, but no actual unconditional proof. Evidence that there's not a bridge. That's right, yeah. Yeah.
So the systems that are being simulated or asked about are necessarily the quantum and classical systems, the computer
set. Yeah, so you can start to define models that don't necessarily look like they have anything to do with physics. I mean, this one is more of an algebraic definition. I mean, in the end, the models I'm writing up on the board here are only the ones that people think of as corresponding to realistic universal models of computation. So other things you can define include non-realistic models of computation, such as NP. This has been mentioned in a previous lecture. It's some kind of model where your Turing machine has the ability to take guesses, basically, and then as long as the probability of this guess being correct is non-zero, it automatically lands on the correct answer. You can make up these fanciful imaginary models of computation. And those have their uses. They're useful for classifying the difficulty of computational problems. There are certain problems that sort of naturally correspond to these very fictitious models of computation. But what I'm talking about here is ones that we really imagine we can do in the world. Yeah. Yeah. I would say the latter phrasing is closer to what I had in mind. Yeah. So if you tried to build something where the individual logic gates were, you know, little black holes scattering off each other or something. Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, because a lot of these things are defined in a discrete way, it's not so obvious how to take an H bar going to zero limit. Yeah, I've thought about this. Maybe in this case. But most of these things were just defined in terms of a discrete set of unitaries in the first place. You're not even referring to Hamiltonians or actions or anything like that, so that H bar kind of doesn't appear in the formulation. Okay, so this is kind of the perspective. So the model I'll use for the discussion of simulating other physical systems will be quantum circuits. Oh yeah. So the question was whether there's a sensible H bar going to zero limit for some of these models, and my response was that, for the most part, I'm not aware of such a way of formulating things. Okay, so this is kind of the point of view I'll take. I should mention, though, that a somewhat more commonly used way of talking about things is in terms of complexity classes, at least among complexity theorists. And it might be tempting to think of these blobs, these equivalence classes, as being complexity classes. That's not quite right, because complexity classes are defined in terms of sets of problems. This is just kind of a brief aside. So, for example, P is the set of problems that you can solve in polynomial time on classical computers, say Turing machines, for example. BQP is a set of problems solvable in polynomial time using quantum computers. For example, NP is a set of problems whose solutions, if they were handed to you, you could verify in polynomial time on classical computers. And et cetera. There's a lot of complexity classes. If you are curious about it, you can look at something called the Complexity Zoo, which was started by Scott Aronson, which is a nice kind of catalog of these things and their properties. So it is true that sort of P corresponds to this equivalence class of models. And I'll cross this off. And BQP sort of corresponds. Oops, I got it reversed. Okay. Well, you see what I'm saying. P corresponds to the classical computing models because this is what these models can solve. BQP corresponds to this, but as sets, they're not the same thing. And also, the emphasis is different. Here, we're trying to classify problems, which is why we also include things that don't correspond to anything that we can really do in the world. We have some model of computation that corresponds to this, which is this fanciful one with magical lucky guessing. The purpose of this is to classify the problems. All right. So, yeah. Yeah.
Is that actually, you know, for people wrote papers establishing links in practice, you establish a link by showing that A is
similar
to
B,
or is there some other
notion? No, I think that's really what you do. I mean, another point is that you may want to fill in extra links that you don't technically need. Like, let's say you want to simulate adiabatic quantum computation with quantum circuits. You wouldn't necessarily want to do so by composing this simulation method with this simulation method, because this might have, you know, quadratic overhead and this has cubic overhead. You compose them and you get something with a sixth power overhead, which is no good. So you might write a separate paper finding a more efficient way to go directly. And so that's the kind of thing that people do. Okay. So that almost concludes the sort of first segment of this talk. I'll just make one little aside, sort of for the experts, which is that it's not quite true that these are the only things out there. There are other models that people have made which are kind of interesting. There's something called the one clean qubit model, where you operate on only very high entropy, highly mixed quantum states. There's something called the instantaneous quantum polynomial time, where you only are allowed to use commuting gates. And there are various things like this, which are actually probably weaker than full-blown universal quantum computers, but still capable of doing some things that you can't do in polynomial time classically. And it's a very interesting subject, but kind of for the purposes of this talk, I'll just dismiss those as, well, those are just non-universal models. We're kind of going to sweep them under the rug for now. We won't focus on that. But it is another interesting subject which you can read about. Okay. So that's the framework. And we'll start to move towards actually showing how some of these simulations work, and in particular, how to simulate Hamiltonian dynamics using quantum computers. But I think it helps to give a little bit more history and context before that, so we know that what are really the right questions and what are the kind of the dangers that we should look out for in our thinking. So I'll give just a very brief historical summary. And I think, as is standard practice in physics lectures, this history is not going to be up to the standard of real scholarly historians. It's going to be optimized for pedagogical value instead. Okay. So here's my sort of cartoonized history lesson. So by, I would say, about 1980 or so, this program of, you know, proving one model equivalent to another had become very successful, almost to the point of getting repetitive. And so from this experience, the complexity theorists extrapolated something which could be called the extended Church-Turing thesis. And basically, what it says is any reasonable model of universal computation is polynomially equivalent to classical Turing machines. What's that? Right. So this was about 1980 or so. This is what people thought. So the comment was, this excludes quantum computers. And so that's right. So quantum computers, as we now know, are the thing that came along and really caused us to believe that actually this basic principle of computer science, which people really believed back then, we now think is not actually true, and we have kind of a new replacement for it. So this is a kind of a exciting thing. It's got this grandiose name, it's got this box around it, so it's just begging to be challenged. And so quantum computers were actually not the first challenge to come along to this. And I think it's very instructive to look at what some of the other challenges were that came before quantum computers, and then we can see why quantum computers really are different. So, some challenges were, first of all, analog computing. So if you formally define models of analog computing, when you abstract away and look at the mathematical underlying structure, usually what it amounts to is the ability to do arithmetic on the reals. So you say, okay, we can do arithmetic on the real numbers, and sometimes people have in mind specific means of realizing this by physical systems, whether it be analog electrical circuits or some kind of mechanical systems of gears and pulleys and whatever. And there have been some fairly carefully formulated formal models of this. So Claude Shannon formulated a model called the general purpose analog computer model. And basically, the allowed operations are addition, multiplication, integrators, and variables that are just set to a constant, and you can plug these together into some circuit to compute stuff. Another one, which is maybe a little more modern, and maybe even the best studied of these, is the Blum-Shub-Smail model, which basically, the basic gates are you can evaluate rational functions. And if you study these models, for example, the Blum-Shub-Smail model, this has been proven carefully. Within these models, you can actually get extreme computational power. You can solve NP-hard problems using only polynomially many of these elementary operations, which is something that's believed to be exponentially difficult for conventional Turing machines. So the question is, do analog computers really pose a challenge to this thesis here? And what it seems to be the case is the answer is no. And the reason is that once you take into account realistic imprecisions in your components, realistic sources of noise, these apparent exponential speedups that you get using these analog systems go away. And intuitively, it kind of makes sense, because if you imagine that, you know, you can only distinguish signals that differ by at least some minimal amount epsilon, then what you've got back is a discrete system. And maybe I'll include here another one. There's some very nice lectures online by Scott Aronson about a soap bubble computer and why that does not pose a challenge to the Church-Turing thesis. In theory, if you have like a bunch of pegs and you dip it into soapy water, the energy due to the surface tension should be minimized, which will give you the minimal spanning tree for this set of pegs, which is an NP-hard problem. So in principle, you might think this is a way of solving NP-hard problems, but of course what really happens is you get stuck in local optima a lot of times. Okay, so this was a challenge that was proposed, but which we now really think does not truly challenge this thesis. Okay, another obvious one, relativistic computing. So the most naive version of this is, well, let's just exploit time dilation. You leave your computer here on Earth, set it to computing something, you accelerate to close to the speed of light and come back, and you haven't aged that much, and you read off the answer to your computation. But this one is pretty easy to dismiss, because remember, what we care about is exponential speedups. Polynomial speedups are no big deal to the Church-Turing thesis. And you can easily show that in order to get an exponential speedup this way, you need to expend exponential energy, which you really just couldn't possibly have. Okay. Now, what about curved space-time? So in this case, it's not quite so clear. So first of all, people have studied what happens if you have closed time-like curves. And of course, nobody really knows what you have with closed time-like curves. But there are models that have been proposed that try to deal with this consistently and avoid the grandfather paradox. I think Scott Aronson mentioned one yesterday, which is, if you think that these closed time-like curves are associated with some quantum operation, it turns out that any quantum operation has a fixed point. And so if you imagine the system goes to the fixed point, there's no paradoxes. So for example, if you try to go back and kill your grandfather, the fixed point of that is 50% you do and 50% you don't. That's fixed under this, this reversal map. And in this case, you can show that depending on which exact model you choose, you can show that you do have exponential computational power. You can solve NP or even bigger classes like p-space and get exponential speedups. But on the other hand, you might say, all right, well, maybe we should restrict our attention to slightly less pathological space-time, something that might seem more plausible. Now, another thing that's been proposed is something called Malament-Hogarth space-times, at Hogarth. And this is kind of an interesting model where you have two time-like curves, one of which has a finite proper time, and one of which has infinite proper time. They both start at the same place, but this entire curve is contained in the past light cone of the endpoint of this one. So in space-time, which admit these kind of curves, the argument is, in principle, you could send your computer off in this spaceship, and you could ride in this spaceship, and then after a while, you look back in your telescope, and you see the output that the computer has produced using as much time as it wants. And interestingly, one of the space-times that allows these kind of curves to exist within it is actually anti-de Sitter space. Now, my hunch is that this is not really such a sensible model because, first of all, probably this takes a ridiculous amount of energy to go along this path. And secondly, when you look back through your telescope, presumably these signals from here are going to be unbelievably blue shifted. So I suppose when you look back and try to see the answer, you're not going to see the answer. It's just going to burn your eyeballs out. So that's maybe not such a good computer. I think I would ask for my money back for that one. But the apparently, as far as I can tell, it's never really been studied. These questions about, you know, what's the blue shift? What's the energy cost? Can you do this in a way that's actually physical? Or is it always just unphysical? I don't think that's been answered. That might even be a pretty easy problem for some of the general relativity experts in the audience, and I think that's somewhat something that would be very interesting if someone worked it out. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so the question is, in the soap bubble example, I mentioned things getting stuck in local optima, and this not being a completely reliable way of solving optimization problems. But there are a lot of experiments out there about cooling things down. You may have heard of this machine made by a company called D-Wave here in Canada, which is trying to solve optimization problems by adiabatically producing ground states of kind of spin glass quantum Hamiltonians. And how does that fit into this picture? So what I would say is that this complexity theory, you know, which things can simulate, which others, which problems can you solve in polynomial time, is formulated in terms of worst case instances. What we're really interested in, can we always solve this problem? What people are interested in practice oftentimes is, well, we've got some ensemble of problems which arises in practice from maybe, you know, airplane scheduling problems or circuit layout problems or something. And amongst instances from that ensemble, you know, can we solve most of them? And so these things that I say can get stuck in local minima and therefore cannot solve all of NP efficiently, they still might be useful heuristic methods that could solve a lot of instances of problems. And so that's kind of the motivation for a lot of these. Yeah. Right. And in. Well, not always. I mean, so I would say sometimes there could be some systems you could make, and you wait for them to cool, and the amount of time it would take them to reach their actual ground state could be much longer than the lifetime of the universe. And so even the universe itself does not solve those computational problems. It never. Yeah, so the question is, well, what about things that are just close to the ground state? And then it's the same kind of situation. So like in some cases, there are actual proofs that even things close to the ground state can't be efficiently computed, but that whole aspect is not as theoretically well understood as the ground state problem. So that's kind of really the research frontier, like trying to prove that things that even close to the ground state can't be obtained in general. Oh, yeah, so the classical PCP theorem, so for classical systems, we understand that we can prove for quite a large class of systems that even things close to the ground state you can't find. For the quantum case, that's like a big research topic now. Okay, so, all right, so that's enough about these other challenges, and let's now move to our main topic again, which is quantum computing. So as we know, the notion of quantum computation was formulated in the 80s by people like Feynman, Deutsch, Manin, and some others. And this was another case where it looked like, well, okay, maybe you could simulate, you could solve things that would take exponential time on a classical computer. And so, yeah, I decided to skip it for time. Okay, so we'll rename this as 3. Okay, so quantum computing. All right, I'll mention 3. 3 is things like quantities that come up in theoretical physics, like the partition function, the ground state energy. A lot of these things are NP hard to compute in general. And so you might think, aha, I found a quantity in my formulation of theoretical physics, which is NP hard to compute, therefore the that nature is computing NP-hard things. But that's not really a correct conclusion, because for a model of computation, you really need to be able to choose inputs and extract outputs. Something like a partition function, it's not directly something you can measure. And so just because some quantity comes up in the middle of what you write down as a theorist on paper doesn't mean that it's really something that you could evaluate using some laboratory experiment. OK, so that was three theoretical quantities. And four is quantum computing. So when quantum computing was first proposed as something that could maybe get exponential speed up over classical computers, there was initially a lot of skepticism from computer scientists. They said, oh, well, we've heard this story before. It's just like the analog computers. Your apparent exponential speed ups are just an artifact of failing to take into account realistic noise models. And at the time, that was actually a very reasonable objection to raise. But now we know something that we didn't know back in the 80s, which was proved in the mid-90s, I think simultaneously by several groups, one of which was Aharonov and Ben-Or. And this is called the threshold theorem. And I consider it to be one of the most important facts about quantum computing, which everyone should know. And so I'll draw a box around it. So I'll state it loosely. So consider the quantum circuit model. If the error per operation, say per elementary quantum gate, is below some fixed threshold, so which say might be, say, 0.1% or something like this, then arbitrarily long quantum computations, arbitrarily many gates, can be carried out reliably using error correction and sort of correcting errors as you go along. Error-correcting codes, which Daniel Gottesman has told us about. And this incurs only logarithmic overhead. There's only a logarithmic cost to this error correction. And so this, I think, is really the key fact which shows that quantum computation is fundamentally different from, say, these analog models that people came up with before. Even if you assume some constant epsilon error, you can still retain these exponential speedups. And so this really, I think, is a very serious reason to take quantum computing very seriously. Now, there are still questions about this. There's still research on this topic. People try to develop schemes which can tolerate higher noise levels, ones which have lower overhead, ones which apply to ever more general noise models involving highly correlated or non-Markovian noise. But I think as far as the basic question is concerned, my opinion, not everyone's opinion, but I think mine and most people's, is that this basically settles the issue as to whether quantum computation is a fundamentally reasonable and in principle realizable model of computation. It's certainly very hard to build these things, but it seems like they're fundamentally realistic. Yeah, so for classical digital computers, you generally don't actually need to use active error correction in the course of your computations in practice, because the error rate is really low, like 10 to the minus 11 or something. However, it is also true that for threshold theorems were proven, I think already in the 60s by von Neumann, for classical computing. And actually, the threshold theorems for the quantum case are kind of loosely modeled on the proof techniques that von Neumann used. So you could think of those as in principle providing a foundation for digital quantum computing, even though in practice we don't really usually need to use those error correction techniques. Right, analog models, there's no threshold theorem. Yeah, that, and probably one doesn't exist. Okay, so then this leads us to our replacement, which is the quantum Church-Turing thesis, and we can just put the word quantum in the appropriate places in this box, a quantum Turing machine. So this is what the situation is today. This is what is kind of the bold claim that we can start to challenge and investigate. Is it really true that quantum computers can simulate everything efficiently? So that's what the rest of these lectures will, today and Monday, will be devoted to. Okay, so now let's get to the technical meat of this. We're going to start thinking of different physical systems which a priori might not be efficiently simulated by quantum Turing machines, or in fact, we'll use as our standard model the quantum circuits because it's easier to work with, and we'll start to show how we can simulate these using quantum computers. Now, yeah. Yeah. So, one way to phrase it is that suppose we did come up with some physical system which, as far as we can tell, cannot be simulated efficiently by any quantum algorithm. Then we would be in a situation kind of analogous to the situation that Feynman and Deutsch found themselves in the 80s, where here's some physical system which apparently requires exponential resources to simulate using the computers that we know about. And so that suggested to them, well, maybe these physical systems harbor exponentially more computational power than our existing computers. So that's how quantum computation got started. And this intuition that they had was borne out by subsequent developments, most famously Peter Schur's discovery of a polynomial time quantum algorithm for factoring. But this was kind of the first hint that these quantum systems might be useful for some very difficult computational tasks. So that could repeat itself. In principle, we could say, oh, well, you know, some super Yang-Mills something or other, we can't simulate it with a standard quantum computer. Maybe we could use those things and solve some other hard problems. On the other hand, maybe we find that everything can be simulated for a quantum computer. Then we kind of answer this sort of, well, first of all, we get quantum algorithms for simulating things. That could be useful someday when we have quantum computers. And also, it addresses this, I think, very fundamental question. What is the set of problems that we can solve in polynomial time in our universe? And if we find that everything can be simulated by quantum circuits in polynomial time, then we know the answer to that. It's this complexity class BQP, which has been carefully characterized and about which we know a lot. And we know what something about what problems are in there. So I'd say that's kind of what's at stake. Yeah, I would say the default guess is now that this is true. Yeah. So right now, I don't think we have any specific plausible candidates for physical systems that cannot be efficiently simulated by quantum computers. Okay, so how are we going to do these simulations? So fundamentally, we're going to use as our basic model of computation the quantum circuit model. So we have a bunch of little unitaries acting on qubits. We string them together. We perform some big unitary, and that does our computation. Now, that's been presented by John Watrous, and so I won't belabor it too much. And I also not, in practice, really use this language to describe the quantum algorithms. That's kind of like describing things in assembly language on a classical computer. In principle, you could describe everything that way, but it's not very convenient. So we're going to build up a somewhat higher level language. So we act on qubits. Our states our superpositions like this. We write bit strings and kets, that will be our notation. And we have some gates, things like the Hadamard gate, which is a little 2x2 unitary, things like the controlled NOT gate, which we draw like this, acting on 2 qubits. This is some 4x4 unitary correspondingly. And we build things up out of these. But like I said, let's develop a little bit higher level language for describing our algorithms. Something not so much like assembly language, sort of the quantum analog of like C or Python or something. Okay, so I'll introduce a list of basic primitives. All of these can pretty much be found in chapter 4 of Nielsen and Chuang, which is what I recommend as supplemental reading if you're interested in. And for the most part, I won't give proofs of the fact that these are things that you can do with polynomially many gates. I won't, for the most part, exhibit the circuits to do this. We'll just say, okay, these are our primitives in each one. If we wanted to, we could decompose it into gates efficiently. So tool number one is classical computing. Writing in terms of these unitaries, it's not so obvious that you can even do universal classical computation, but you can. And so suppose we have some function on bit strings which we can evaluate efficiently classically using some network of logic gates. Well, one thing we can do in our quantum computer is we can always construct some quantum circuit, which I'll just draw as a box, and I won't worry about what gates are inside this box. We can always make something that does this. The input comes back out, and the output gets added into the output register, mod 2 to the m. And you can verify that this is a unitary operation. The number of gates you need inside this box is up to constant factors, basically the same as the number of gates in your classical computation for this thing. So this is called reversible computing. And sometimes people put slashes through lines here where this line is not meant to represent a qubit, it's meant to represent a group of qubits. So here, like, this is n qubits, which maybe we could think of representing a number from 0 to 2 to the n minus 1, and so on. And we call these registers of qubits. So that's our tool number one, reversible computing. We can always compute stuff that we could have computed classically. And in particular, you see that if you set y equals 0 here, then you just get f of x written in your output register, which is sometimes what you want to do. Okay. So, tool number two, which we can build fairly directly out of tool number one, is something called phase kickback. Again, you start by postulating there's some function that you can compute classically. Now what we want to do, instead of computing it written in bits into some register of qubits, we want to compute it into the phases. So here we have the same f, let's say, and what we want to do is we have some arbitrary quantum state, and this gets mapped to the same thing but with phases f on it. And what I will assert to you is that we can do this with an efficient quantum circuit as long as f can be efficiently computed classically. Actually, the trick for this is sufficiently simple and cute that I'll just show it to you. What you do is consider this state. So if you think about this state, you can see it's just a plane wave. It's an eigenstate of translation. If you translate it, you get a phase. And so in other words, if you add some number, f of x to here, then modulo m, you've just changed the dummy variables, you've accrued a phase which is proportional to f. So what you do is you just take this state, instead of zero, you feed this thing into the output register, and now what happens is this same state comes back out, and this whole thing gets multiplied by a phase of e to the I f of x with some factors of 2 pi and whatever in there. Okay, at the end, you could always just throw this state away. Ultimately, it's used sort of catalytically. Now, a question you should ask is, well, where do we get this state in the first place? So it's sort of like a little warning that I should give you, which is that in studying quantum algorithms, you should only use states that you know how to efficiently make. If you just allow yourself arbitrary states to start with, you could fool yourself. You could start to think that you can solve things efficiently, which you really can't. But we will show how to make this state using, let's see here, tool number 5 or so, which is a Fourier transform. So this is just a Fourier transform of a basis state. We can make that. So that's skipping ahead. Okay. So next, a simple one. Tool number 4 is controlled unitaries. So anytime you can do some unitary U by an efficient quantum circuit, you could always do something which is called controlled U, which means if this qubit is a 1, we apply U to this register. If this qubit's a 0, we do nothing. So as a matrix, this is like a block matrix with identity up here and U down here, if we order the qubits as the bit strings as the ones that start with 0 are on top and the ones that start with 1 are down here. So we can always do that. Okay, so that's going to be most of our high-level language. I'll introduce a couple of things, but before I do, I'll make one remark, which is that if you're going to stop talking about gates and start talking only in a high-level language, you should make sure that your high-level language captures everything that the gates could do. You want it to be universal. You want it to be complete. We've already achieved that. In fact, we already achieved that just with classical computing and Fourier transform. It's this kind of acute observation. So let me just state this. Classical computing plus Fourier transform is universal. And how we can prove this is as follows. So let me write down what the Fourier transform is first. So I'll call this, what are we up to now? Fourier transform, lost track of the numbers. So this one is, I'll write it like this. And we have some arbitrary superposition, which maps to Fourier transform is now the new coefficients of the, which are the Fourier transform of the old coefficients. And this is a discrete Fourier transform defined like this. We'll say it's on dimension n. Plus I okay, so that's what our Fourier transform tool is. So if we just use this and classical computing, we can already do everything that quantum computers can do. And a way to see that is if we think of the Fourier transform with capital N equals 2, in other words, the single qubit Fourier transform, then this e to the I 2 pi over n is just minus 1. So this looks like this matrix. That's what the Fourier transform is on a single qubit. And this is called the Hadamard gate. So that's a special case. A special case of this construction is, suppose F is something that takes two bits of input and just computes the AND of them. So in that case, AND so this is a gate which adds modulo 2 down here, the AND of these two inputs. So in other words, x, y, z, this is z, added modulo 2, x and y. That gate also has a name. This is a 3-qubit gate called the Toffoli gate. And it's known that the Hadamard gate and the Toffoli gate are sufficient to do universal quantum computation. A nice proof of this is given in one of Dorit's papers, which is QuantPH 0301040. That's another good supplemental reading. And there's kind of an interesting observation here, which is both of these gates involve only real transition amplitudes. There's no complex numbers. And so that's just a fact about quantum computing. You don't actually need complex numbers to get universal computational power in quantum mechanics. All right. So we've already got a complete set of tools. I'll just, nevertheless, introduce one more because it's handy for describing things. That's our purpose here in making a higher level language. We want to concisely describe quantum algorithms and not get mired in the details of writing things out gate by gate. So the last one is arbitrary unitaries. And so suppose U is an n by n unitary. So if this is acting on some number, say lowercase n of qubits, then this would be 2 to the little n by 2 to the little n. So that's the n qubit case. Well, it turns out that you can always make this using order n squared log n elementary quantum gates. Now, that is if you have a sufficiently rich gate set. If you're using Hadamard and Toffoli, then if U has complex amplitudes, you can't actually make it. You can simulate it. But let's assume you have a more complete gate set than that, such as Hadamard, Toffoli, and a phase gate. In that case, you really can make exactly these unitaries. And so notice that in terms of qubits, this means if you have some unitary acting on logarithmically many qubits, then you can always make it efficiently. And this is shown in Nielsen and Chuang, section 4.2, if you're interested in seeing how this works. I'm not going to show you. OK, so that's our high-level language. Now let's actually apply it to the title of this lecture, which is Simulating Hamiltonians. We've finally reached that point. So are there any questions at this point? Okay. So let's start with trivial things first. That's always a good start. So let's simulate a diagonal Hamiltonian on n qubits. We can actually get this as really a direct corollary of the tools that we've already introduced. So now consider some 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space. And our Hamiltonian is just a diagonal thing. So we can think of these bit strings of length n as representing numbers from 0 to 2 to the n minus 1. And so our Hamiltonian can be written like this. So now what we want is to make some quantum circuit implementing the corresponding unitary time evolution induced by applying this time-independent Hamiltonian. So e to the minus I ht, which is equal to e to the minus I h of 0 t, e to the minus I h of 1 t, and so on down the diagonal. So I guess you could say an instance of this. So right now we're not going to worry about initial states. So how to produce the initial states is kind of a central topic in lecture number 2 on Monday. So right now our input is this function little h. So we assume we're given some classical formula or some classical algorithm which, given some number, can compute this function of that number. So for example, maybe we could think of this as being, in a one-dimensional non-relativistic quantum mechanics problem with some potential. If we're working in the position basis, that potential, say like x squared or something, could be what this formula is. So we can always compute the square of a number efficiently. So that would be an example of this problem. That's a good question. Okay, so how are we going to do this? Well, this is exactly the phase kickback problem. We just saw how to do this. We have some state that we start with. For now, we'll not worry about where it comes from, although we will worry about that extensively on Monday. We compute this function h. We add it into our output register. Mod, say 2 to the m, if m's our number of digits of precision that we're computing with. And now what we have here is e to the minus, so now what we have here is and really we should write 2 pi over 2 to the n here, but I'm not going to worry about these constants. So this thing, in turn, we could have made it using a Fourier transform. This is the Fourier transform of the one state. We can throw this away at the end. And so what we have is this circuit gives us psi goes to e to the minus I h t psi. Oh, I forgot to put a t here. So that's how we're going to simulate a diagonal Hamiltonian. Now from this, we can start taking little steps, each of which are pretty simple, and build our way towards simulating more and more general and realistic Hamiltonians. So as the second step, example number 2, suppose we have some Hamiltonian that's diagonal in the Fourier basis. So suppose we have some Hamiltonian H sub k, which conjugated by a Fourier transform is diagonal. So we'll say, put tildes here for Fourier transforms. And this matrix we can call, say, h tilde. So now what we want to do is implement the unitary time evolution induced by this time-independent Hamiltonian. So what's our quantum circuit going to look like? Well, let's write down a formula first from which we can read off the quantum circuit that does this. So just very simple math. So can you see what the corresponding quantum circuit for this is? See, what you'll do is just sort of think of this as a box and a box and a box and tie them together. So remember, we know how to do Fourier transforms on a quantum computer. So we put one like this. We do our usual phase kickback as long as this function h tilde of k is something that we can compute. I should also multiply it by t here, which I forgot to do before. Here's our special magic eigenstate of addition, which we can in turn make by Fourier transforming 1. And then we Fourier transform back. And this is our quantum circuit for doing e to the minus I h tilde t. So these are our building blocks. Now let's finally get to something a little bit more physical. So let's now move on to freshman quantum mechanics. Let's try to simulate on a quantum computer Schrodinger's equation for some particle on a line subject to some potential. So here's Schrodinger's equation. And what we want to do is simulate this corresponding time evolution on a quantum computer. So I'll just give this Hamiltonian a name, say H non-relativistic. That's what we want to do. So one thing that we can notice about Hn relativistic is that actually it's composed of two terms, each of which we individually know how to simulate the time evolution that they induce. So if we look at this term, the potential, that's diagonal in the x basis. So let's say we're going to work in the x basis. We're going to store this position x on our quantum computer using some number of qubits, some number of bits of precision. And this term, the kinetic term, is diagonal in the p basis, which is the Fourier transform of the x basis. So more generally, whenever you have a pair of canonically conjugate variables, their eigenbases are related by a Fourier transform that follows from their commutation relations. It's a fun exercise to prove that. So now we're faced with a question. We've got these two individual terms. We know how to simulate each one. How do we simulate their sum? And the answer to that question, or an answer to that question anyway, is using Suzuki-Trotter formulas. So here's what they look like. So there's actually an infinite sequence of these things. So the first order one is like this. You have arbitrary Hermitian operators, A and B. And what you have is like this. So this is just some, you can show this by Taylor expanding. Second order Suzuki-Trotter is a little bit better. The errors are only order delta t cubed. And then you can come up with arbitrarily high order versions of these things, and which give you better and better approximations, but we won't go beyond this. That's just technical stuff. It's sort of liberating that all we care about right now is just proving things can simulate each other with polynomial time, and beyond that, we don't care about efficiency. This saves a lot of effort. So what this means is that if we want to simulate e to the I a plus b, we can do something like this. Put t's back in. I guess we should have minus signs for time evolution forwards. So this formula that I've written right here just follows directly from the first order Trotter-Suzuki, which I've written down. Because if you, yeah.
Is it important that each step is not, does it matter that each step is not unitary the way that you've written it?
It is unitary. Because this, yeah, this thing, each A and B are each Hermitian. Okay. And so this is a unitary and this is a unitary and we take their product.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yep. So we can see this formula from here, because if we look inside one of these parentheses, this is going to be e to the I a plus b t over n plus order 1 over n squared. We take that thing to the nth power, and then there's going to be n of these little 1 over n squared things that we add up, which gives us our total error of 1 over n. So this shows us what to do. This is another case where from a formula you can kind of read off what the corresponding quantum circuit is. what we want to do is, if we want to simulate the sum of two Hamiltonians, we can just sort of flick back and forth between simulating one and the other for short amounts of time. In a way, I think that's kind of intuitive. Like if you imagine you flick on back and forth these two different things, it's kind of like you're simulating the average of them or the sum of them. So now we can write down, yeah. Yes. It's kind of funny. So I'm not sure whether that's just because this analysis is kind of getting a loose bound on the errors, or if it's really true that just changing at the very beginning it makes a difference. I think probably it's just that this analysis is loose. Like, you know, secretly the errors actually are a little bit better than this, but already just kind of naive first order, we get something that's good enough for present purposes. Yeah, that's a good observation. Okay, so now we can go back to our problem at hand, and we can write down a quantum circuit for this. And I think the timing is just right. This quantum circuit for simulating non-relativistic quantum mechanics can be sort of the culmination of this lecture. And then next time we'll worry about simulating more sophisticated quantum systems like quantum field theories, how to prepare the initial states, how to do measurements, and all of the other more non-trivial issues that come up in quantum simulation. So what does this formula look like as a circuit? I'll erase a lot of space because it's a big circuit to draw. Just looks like this. So let's say we alternate between the kinetic term first, and then potential term, kinetic potential. So what our circuit looks like, we start with some state psi, which for now we'll just take as given. Now we want to simulate for a short time step evolution induced by the kinetic term. Here's our magic eigenstate of addition thing. And we do what we just showed. We compute p squared, let's say 2m equals 1, h bar equals 1. Let's forget about all that stuff. So we compute p squared times our time step delta t. We add it down here. That kicks back the phase. And now we Fourier transform back to the position basis. So that's kind of like the e to the I p squared delta t. And then we do our phase kickback trick with v delta t. Add that. That kicks back this phase. So here's an e to the I v of x delta t. And then we just alternate. Do this thing again. Do this thing again. And back and forth and back and forth until we've done 1 over delta t time steps. And this approximates what we wanted, which is our time evolution induced by this Hamiltonian. This thing never got entangled. I mean, at the end, it's not entangled with our final state, so we can throw it away. And that's what we wanted to do. So that's how we simulate non-relativistic quantum mechanics on the line. Simulating things like chemical reactions and stuff is basically kind of a generalization of the same idea. It's not so different. You're tracking more variables. You are doing Fourier transforms over more variables. These potentials are more complicated. But it's essentially the same idea. And so that's our basic tool. Next time, what's on the agenda? This will be Monday at 9 a.m. How do we make the states? What kind of observables can we extract information about at the end of our simulation? And how do we simulate more complicated systems like quantum field theories, which might have issues with discretization and state preparation? In principle, there's infinitely many degrees of freedom to worry about. And discuss some of what are the big open problems, what are the frontiers of research in this subject. So I think I'll stop here. Thanks. Okay, yeah, so there are two questions. One is, what about non-Hermitian Hamiltonians? So What I'll say is that there may be special cases where you can do that, but there's good reasons to believe you can't do that in general. So here's an example. So suppose you have some Hamiltonian, which is like just made out of sigma z's. So all you have is a Hamiltonian on n spins, which looks like this. So then you might say, okay, well, let's simulate a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian, which is I times this. So in other words, what we're doing is minus ht, e to the minus ht is our time evolution now, instead of e to the, I guess it's minus, so call h prime equals minus I h, and this is e to the minus I h prime t is e to the minus ht. So if you think about this operator, what does this do? Well, in the eigenbasis, it's diagonal and looks like e to the minus e naught t, e to the minus e1 t, and so on. So this is rapidly projecting you down onto the ground state of this system. Oh, yep, thanks. So, and let's say the gap between E0 and E1 is gamma, so after time like order 1 over gamma, you'll like be mostly in the ground state of this thing. But in general, you can't do that, because actually, it's proven that finding the ground state to this kind of classical spin glass problem is already an NP hard problem. So in general, it's not believed that there's any polynomial time, classical or quantum algorithm that can solve all instances of this. So there definitely exist some examples of non-Hermitian Hamiltonians, like this one, which we don't believe can be efficiently simulated. But there may be special cases where you can't. So then the other question had to do with, well, what about more real systems where it's not zero temperature? Maybe that's my sort of paraphrasing of the question. And there is a big body of work about how to simulate non-zero temperature things on quantum computers. You might think that in general this should be an easier problem than zero temperature stuff because maybe it's less quantum. On the other hand, it gets kind of complicated, and I would say it's less well understood than the problem of simulating zero temperature stuff and closed systems on quantum computers. So there's papers about this, there's many things known, but I'd say there's a lot of work that's still being done on that. Yeah, so I guess that those are my comments. Yeah, you are. If you can do it in the lab, you're solving the problem. You're building some system, it produces the answer. The answer you produce, whatever it was something that's feasible to compute in our universe, and either it's some problem that's intrinsically easy, or it could be an instance of a NP-hard problem, which in that particular case isn't hard, or it's just because the problem size is not asymptotic when you don't see the asymptotic scaling, or maybe you're getting a local optima. Many different things can happen, but I would say, like, fundamentally, if you can do it in the lab, that's something you can compute. Yeah, sometimes you're not, because it doesn't always go to the actual ground state. I see. So your comment is that in the real world, there are systems that are a little bit quantum. And when I drew this chart, there was just a very sharp distinction. I mean, so these things that are a little bit quantum, I think are kind of fall under this, what I was calling the non-universal models. And so for example, a very interesting example, I think, is stochastic adiabatic computation, is what it's called, which means that you're evolving with some time-dependent Hamiltonian, but it has the property, and you do it slowly enough so that by the adiabatic theorem, you stay in the ground state of this thing. And the Hamiltonian is such that the ground state can always be expressed using only real non-negative amplitudes. So this actually corresponds to, for example, the kind of Hamiltonian that they use in the D-wave machine. And the question is, how quantum is that really? Because you do have entanglement in these states. You do have tunneling going on. So these are some quantum things. One thing you don't really have, in some sense, there's no interference effects that are being manifested in these systems. So if you take away interference, is that quantum enough to give you exponential speedups? And that's a big open question, which I think is a very interesting one. Well, so there are people who have studied this in a fairly serious way, both at Harvard and at Microsoft. They have been mainly focusing on simulations of chemical systems. They do it in a somewhat different way than what I showed here. They don't operate directly into the position basis for the individual particles. They operate in terms of orbitals. And those algorithms are inferior to this one in terms of their asymptotic scaling, but they are superior for small instances, apparently. And they've done some work optimizing these. And in principle, you can, according to them, get speedups, solve problems that are kind of borderline infeasible, even for large classical supercomputers, already using only on the order of a few hundred logical qubits. On the other hand, the number of gates involved is rather large for these algorithms, typically. And to get a few hundred logical qubits, normally what you have to do is encode these into quantum error correcting codes, which then means the number of actual physical qubits you need is much larger if you want things to be able to be scalable. On the other hand, if you want to solve a small instance with a small number of gates, you can in principle just say, well, let's get each gate to precision 1/1,000, and we can run up to 1,000 gates before we get totally off track. There might be something in that regime that you can actually do which classical computers struggle with, but these chemistry examples, which are kind of motivated by real-world applications, don't quite fit into that box. So right now we're in this situation where the near-term quantum computers, what we know is like, well, there's a few kind of made-up problems like let's run a random quantum circuit, which you might be able to do with these pre-threshold non-error-corrected quantum computers, which are sort of out of reach for classical supercomputers. And then we have these problems which are a little bit beyond that, which are motivated by real chemistry problems that people care about, which still don't use that many qubits, but they're not quite practical for what we can foresee in the near term, I would say.